going to get started discussion of contemporary issues regarding the role of women according to halacha. I'll start off with a statement that was made by Professor Jonathan Sarna. He said that the women are a kind of synecdoche for modernity. What does that mean, synecdoche? Not to be confused with the city of Schenectady. It means women are kind of a measuring stick for how we deal with questions of modernity, with questions of some of the tensions that sometimes seem to exist between halachic norms and requirements and some of the mores and sensibilities of the modern world. We know that one of the raging movements in the modern world is the notion of egalitarianism, of a growing sense of equality between men and women, of women assuming positions and titles that previously had been reserved mostly for men, women playing much more of a major role in the public sphere, women serving as CEOs of companies, and really placing themselves much more in the limelight than may have been customary in previous generations. This has been a challenge for society at large in terms of how to deal with that, how to accommodate this, how to embrace it properly. But it's also a challenge from the standpoint of halacha. Are there limits and parameters that place the halacha at odds with some of the norms and expectations of society? But I would say that if it's true that women are a synecdoche of how we deal with modernity, it also cuts in both directions, because traditionally, in terms of how we have always preserved our tradition and how we have maintained our faith and our spirits and our fidelity to Torah throughout the generations, women have played a very pivotal role in that sense. The Pasuk in Mishlei says, Shema b'ni Musar avicha v'al titosh Torah simecha. The Torah that we have, we describe that as Torah simecha. It's the mothers who imbue us, who imbue all the families with a sense of fidelity, of faith towards tradition. It could very well be the mothers who say you're moving too fast and you shouldn't adopt the same norms of egalitarianism that are being adopted by the rest of society. It's very much the women who hold up the fort. It was Avram who was told by a Kodesh Baruch Hu, Kol Asher Tama Lecha Sarah Shema Bekola, whatever Sarah, your wife, tells you, you may be a great Navi, but your wife is even greater. It's the wives who keep their husbands in shape and make sure that they go to the Beis Medrash to learn and make sure that they keep their mitzvos properly and that they don't veer off the straight path. We're told, Sapta Bevesa, Sima Bevesa. You have an old Jewish grandmother in the house. How many people have had their faith fortified and have maintained the traditions of our patriarchs and matriarchs based on the elderly grandmothers and the saftas and the bubbies who were hanging out in the house and who lent that air of authenticity and were perhaps more effective than anybody else at transmitting the values of our previous generations. And it's also the daughters. We know that when Amram separated from his wife Yocheved because of the terrible decrees that had been promulgated by Paro in Mitzrayim, so it was Miriam who said, you've got to get back together again. You're not allowed to be smarter than HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're supposed to do your thing and let HaKadosh Baruch Hu do his thing. Your decree is worse than Paro's because you are ensuring that there be no continuity of our tradition. So it's the women who actually serve as not only the synecdoche for modernity, but also for tradition. And therefore, it's very, very important that we bear in mind that this is not an exercise in which it's the men sitting around and figuring out what are we going to do with those women, but it's an exercise in Talmud Torah in which anybody can be engaged, and in which the women, of course, themselves play a very, very vital role, as they have played throughout all the generations. As we know, we just celebrated Zman Cheruseinu, and the Gemara in Sota says, "Bischus Noshim Tzidkanios Sheba Oso Ador Migalo Avoseinu Mitzrayim," because of the righteous women from that generation who spurred their husbands to continue to procreate and to have hope for the future, and to preserve the tradition of what is Klal Yisrael, and to move forward in a direction towards Kabbalah Satorah, that we were able to be emancipated from Mitzrayim, that we were able to be meritorious of being redeemed. So that's just a very important introduction. So every single year I give a different version of this year, but it's never my interest in repeating word for word whatever has been said in the past, because this is a moving target on some level. Halacha remains permanent and remains immutable. It's one of the 13 principles of faith articulated by the Rambam. The world around us changes, and therefore the way in which we apply halachic norms and principles to the world around us is going to be different based on the realities and the facts that are on the ground. It's important to recognize, nonetheless, the Torah itself does not change, and that's because the Torah is suited for all times, for all circumstances, and for all generations. Wonderful thing about the Torah. I remember that when I worked as a lawyer, that they decided at one point in time they were going to reform the tax code. One of our tax partners was extremely excited because he had memorized the tax code from beginning to end. They gave him a lot of sipa kanefesh. He got a lot of enjoyment from that, and now he got to learn a totally new tax code. So he was very, very happy about this. Fellow was clearly a masochist of the first order. The great thing about the Torah is that you don't have to worry about there being a new tax code. It's the same Torah. It's the same Torah you can utilize. You never have to change it. You never have to tweak it. You never have to modify it. You never have to reform it. And Rav Soloveitchik was fond of saying, you never have to apologize for it. There's no need to apologize for the Torah. The Torah is something that we're proud of. The Torah is something that we're always very, very excited about. Whatever the Torah says, we have faith, is correct, and we submit ourselves entirely to the Torah, whether we always fully understand everything or not. The Torah is a special gift that we receive from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're extremely appreciative of the Torah, and we have tremendous bitachon that the Torah is capable of dealing with every single situation, including that of a modernity. So this issue of modernity, of how to define women's roles in an ever-changing world, is a major defining issue in our community today. Many of you may be aware there was a commission that was set up by the OU, by the Orthodox Union, this past year, made up mostly of Rosh Yeshiva here from our yeshiva, that met and deliberated over some type of definitive statement that could be promulgated to the community regarding what are appropriate roles for women in the modern age in our Orthodox communities, and what are inappropriate roles, and what are roles that still have yet to be defined and fleshed out, and what should the various considerations be. About a year and a half ago, I suppose, I sat down to write a tshuva on this subject. Since I've spoken about it so much, I figured I'd put something in writing. So I shared with you. I haven't published it yet anywhere officially, but I guess I published it in your emails. So it was sent around, so you have a copy of the tshuva. I prepared it for a specific volume that's supposed to be coming out, God willing, in the near future. And I was heartened to see that most of the substance of the OU statement that was finally issued was consistent, as you'll see if you read the tshuva, in many respects to what I had written. Of course, I shared what I wrote to be very careful, since when you're dealing with such a delicate subject in particular, you have to make sure to consult with your rebbeim, your chaverim, shua v'rov yoetz. I had showed it to Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz Shlita, I showed it to Rav Shechter Shlita, and shown it to Rav Willig Shlita, to make sure that everybody was comfortable with it, and everybody indeed was comfortable with a few ha'aros here and there, all of which were incorporated into the article. This subject really is one that has received a lot of attention in the recent few months, and we'll discuss some of the conclusions of the OU Commission, but much of the source material and the basic parameters that we're going to review are all included in the essay in one form or another. But the truth of the matter is that for all of the hoopla and for all of the commotion, there really shouldn't be much of a problem, and there really shouldn't be much of a tension when dealing with any of these issues, because if you start with the assumption, as we are, that the Torah can provide us with all of the answers and sometimes even help us understand when the answers are a little bit fungible and flexible, then you don't really have to have a sense of tension or a sense of discomfort. As long as everybody who's involved in the conversation, even if some of the questions are hard and even if some of the answers are uncertain, as long as everybody is committed to working together within halakhic boundaries, l'shem shemayim, so there really shouldn't be any tension in the room, because as long as everyone has that sense of commitment, as long as there is a sense that, oh, let's figure out what the Torah wants from us, and let's figure out what the Torah doesn't want from us, and we'll do whatever is required, so everybody can be sort of relaxed about it in the final analysis. Okay, whatever is proper, we'll do, and whatever is improper, we shouldn't do. If there is, in the context of any conversation or deliberation that takes place over the subject, a tremendous amount of tension in the room, then that just raises the red flags. So why is there so much tension? There really shouldn't be. If we all kind of have the same attitude and we all have the same perspective and we all are prepared to submit to whatever the Torah really requires of us, then there shouldn't be any tension. It's only if somebody would superimpose some type of consideration that was not proper according to the Torah, Bein lahachmir, bein lahakel, that would legitimately be a source of tension. But I think it's very important that we begin with the starting point that we all are committed to the idea and to the principle that we simply look into the Torah, that we consult with our Torah authorities in engaging in this analysis, and that we're committed to doing the right thing. Yes?
I was just thinking, maybe this is an important point to address, but like, even if everyone has in mind good intention, no personal nihilism or anything like that, and just looking for MS of Torah, like, it could be tension filled if meeting people have different views on Torah and they're like worried that other people will get angry at them because their views are like troubling to other people.
The Gemara tells us that if it's purely mochamta shel Torah, so we're assured it's vehei besufa, then everybody will get along in the end, because everyone knows that each other's position, no matter how strongly or vociferously expressed, is all based on Torah sources and their interpretation of Torah sources. Of course, you could have a base medrash type of disagreement along those lines, and those could be very fierce disagreements, as we're aware. But as long as they are l'shem shemayim, we believe that the tension gradually dissipates. The tension gradually disappears, because everybody knows what the rules of engagement are. Everybody knows what the rules of arriving at a resolution are. Okay, we have majority rule, we have gedolim, who play a more important and more substantive role in the process. We could come to a certain conclusion if the gedolim disagree, so then we're not able to act upon the conclusions. There are certain principles that we know govern the process, and at the end, everybody can be comfortable if they're committed to those principles. Although, of course, the discussion itself, like any discussion in the base medrash, can be very robust. Now, at the heart of the issues are really a number of different questions, a number of different categories of subjects. One is that of srara, the notion of that there are certain types of positions that maybe are off limits to women based on srara, that they are considered to be positions of authority, and there's some sort of a limitation. You have to figure out what that limitation is on what type of srara can be occupied by a woman. Second issue is that of tznir. So it's tznir lecha simalokecha. We're all supposed to conduct ourselves according to a mode of modesty, according to tznius, according to modest conduct, but there's more of a requirement of tznius that the Torah has imposed upon women, as we know, based on the idea of kol kavuda bas melech penima. So what are the limitations that are created based on tznius? There's also the idea of mesorah, that there are certain ways that things have always been done, that there are certain traditions that are carried over. Traditions are not always halakhic traditions. Sometimes they're that we pass in a certain way, but sometimes the mesorah can be that we've always done things a certain way, or always not done things a certain way. Even our ethical conduct, as is codified in Pirkei Avos, as the Partenura points out at the beginning of Pirkei Avos, this is also part of our Mesorah. That's why we specifically talk about Moshe Kibbutz Torah Misina Mesorah, the Yeshua, Yeshua Lizakadim, in the context of Pirkei Avos, in the context of Musar, in the context of conduct. How do we conduct ourselves? How do we comport ourselves as a community? That's also part of our Mesorah. Goes without saying that things that are Xeris HaKosub, things that are in the realm of what the Torah has ruled are permissible or prohibited or required or not required of women are an essential and an unavoidable part of the discussion as well, because we understand there are mitzvahs esei shezman groma, there are certain mitzvahs that women are not commanded to perform, and that also has some type of applicability in terms of these discussions as well. And finally, there's a discussion regarding smicha. One of the hot button issues in our community over the last number of years has been women rabbis. Can a woman be a rabbi? The answer is, sure, a woman walks in, I've had this at the Beis Din, and she's a reform rabbi. So we're not talking about reform rabbis. The reform movement has made its own calculations in terms of titles, in terms of what mitzvos they feel obligated to perform or not obligated to perform. That's not, when we're having a discussion about halacha, that's not really part of the calculus. Our starting point is that we have fidelity to halacha and maintaining the halacha, but the question is, according to Torah tradition, can a woman receive smicha at all? So these are some of the questions that I want to cover in the course of our remaining time today. Obviously, this is a very deep and a very multi-layered, multi-textured, multi-faceted discussion, and what we can cover in an hour and a half is not going to be completely exhausted. I'm not going to be able to go through even all of the sources that you have in your Mara Mekomos packets. A lot of that is for further reading and for further research, but I want to touch upon the basics. I want to touch upon the fundamentals, and you should feel free during the course of the discussion to ask any questions that come up, because since I'm giving the class, obviously I'm, you know, the final authority on the subject. So that was a joke. But feel free to, you know, engage me in conversation too, because I'm happy to, you know, just contribute my two cents. Now, as far as Sarah is concerned, so it's important to note that while we start off with a Medrash Halacha that teaches us, wherein it says in Parshas Dvarim, Parshas Shoftim, in Sefer Dvarim, Som Tasim Alecha Melech Melech Velo Malka. So we know that there's Xeris HaKosuv, when you appoint a king, you appoint a king, you don't appoint a queen. You don't appoint a queen. Meaning that being a queen, being the monarch of the people, is something which is off limits with respect to an actual appointment. When it comes to women, it's something which is only applicable to it's only applicable to men. There was one author of a person, Surin, who was the author of a sefer called Malki Tzedek, who wanted to argue, no, maybe that just means that Melech Lo Malka means that a king doesn't have to have a queen. If his wife dies and there's no queen, so you could still keep him as king. But if we were talking about appointing a woman as a king, no, that we would call a moleches. We wouldn't call that a malka. You never find that malka is referred to as queen. Even Esther, she was just Achashverosh's wife. So basically that particular theory was debunked by pretty much everybody else. Say for Sheris Yisrael, others who wrote that's completely untrue. Even within Tanakh, we find Malkos Sheva, from the Queen of Sheba, is called Malkos. So you say it's not Malka, Malkas. That's just a rule of grammar. When it's juxtaposed to another word, instead of saying Malko, you say Malkas, but she was a queen from a different nation. So Melech Melo Malko clearly means that a woman is not appointed as a queen. That's the way the Rambam understood it. But Hershon Soren said, the Rambam was a nice posek and certainly a gaon atzum and a gaon olam, and we all follow the rulings of the Rambam regularly, but mechilas kavodo, in this particular case, he thinks the Rambam got it wrong, so everyone said mechilas kavodo of Hirshenstein, we think you got this one wrong. So that was itself an interesting discussion that took place a number of years ago. But let's assume, like the Rambam, Melech Lomalka, that a woman cannot be appointed as a queen. The Rambam takes it a step further, and the Rambam says that we learn from here, She'em Eman Nisha L'Shum Tavkid Shel Srara, woman can't be appointed to any position of authority. Lo Lios Malka, Lo Lios Muna Latziba, she can't be appointed a queen. She can't be appointed to any position of a communal authority, Bechlal, at all. And you find this in the Psikta Zudrasa, you find this in the Midrash Tanaim. Some say these are later Midrashim, you don't find this in early Midrashim, but clearly the Rambam had this. This is codified by the Rambam. We have an interesting comment by Rashi, Alatoro, the Rashi is referring to the first instance of the name of Sarah, that we have a Midrash, and it says Yiska Zusara, that Al Shem Shesocha Beruach HaKodesh, that she was able to see things in her, with her divine spirit. Vashakol Sochin Biopia, that everybody gazed on her because that she was so beautiful. But oh, Yiska Lashon Nesichus. But also Yiska is a Lashon of like a princess, Kamo Sarah Lashon Sarah, like Sarah. The other, now her other name that we know her by, is a Lashon of Sarara. It sounds like Sarah had some sort of a Sarara. So it doesn't sound from Rashi that Sarara is necessarily always off limits when it comes to women. So how do we understand this tension? Well, that of course is a reference, it's an agadic reference to Sarara, it's not a halakhic statement, but perhaps there is some sort of a realm of authority that halakha does deem appropriate when it comes to women. Now, the first line of halakhic analysis is how extensive is this exclusion of Melech Velo Malka. The Rambam applied it to everything. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in a tshuva, this is in Chelek Beis, Simon Memhei B'Yoredeya, Rav Moshe was asked about a woman serving as a mashkicha. So a woman whose husband had been a mashkiach, the couple made their panasa from the fact that the husband did hashkacha, the husband who was the husband passed away. And then the question was whether the almana would be able to continue to serve in this capacity. She needed it for panasa reason. She was a tremendous yirei shemayim. She had a tremendous fear of heaven, and she was very, very observant. There was no question of ulterior motive. She wasn't pushing a feminist agenda or anything like that. But the question was whether this was a problem of Sarara. So Moshe had two chidushim. His first chidush was, yes, he thought that this was a problem of Sarara. He said that Sarara doesn't necessarily mean that it's a glorified type of position. In general, that's not how we understand Sarara. We don't believe that there is a sense of glory in being a leader. It's a sense of responsibility. That's why Rabbi Gamliel said when he wanted to offer two young Talmidei Chachamim in Gemara and Horios, when he found out that they needed some money and they were big Talmidei Chachamim, he wanted to appoint them as Rabbanim, so they declined initially to come forward to meet with him. So he said, you think that I'm giving you a position of authority? I'm giving you servitude. That to be a leader of the Jewish people, to serve in a position of abundance, is one of servitude. That doesn't mean that halakhically we don't consider it to be Sarara. What that means is that Sarara should be understood as a form of servitude. Yes, it is a position in which one has certain authority over the people, but that's one which is not meant to lord over the people, but one which is there so that the leader can serve the people properly by exercising his authority judiciously. That's an important caveat in general with respect to this entire discussion. Nobody is supposed to, according to halakha, nobody's supposed to want to crave a Sarara position, because one of the worst things is to be a panis hamizgayel atzibos, as the Gemara in Chagiga says, to be a leader who tramples over the people in a self-aggrandizing kind of way. So we certainly don't believe in that. We believe that a leader has to see himself as a humble servant of the masses. But nonetheless, It requires exercising a certain amount of authority. What is the nature of that authority? So Rav Moshe writes, it means having authority over the Baal HaBatim. It means that you can tell the Baal HaBatim what to do. If you're a Mashgiach, you can say, if they throw out these pots and pans, they became treif, they're klei cheres, you can't kash them, you got to throw them away. You have to throw away this large shipment of food because it's not kosher and you can't serve it. So this is authority over the Baal HaBatim. So he says it really is Sroah. But then he says, his other chiddush is, that he says that not necessarily everybody agrees with the Rambam. The Rambam says any type of authority is something, any type of position of authority is off limits to women. Says Rav Moshe, he thinks the Sefer Chinuch disagreed, because the Sefer Chinuch, when he talks about the mitzvahs of a melech, just says, well, melech lo malko, a woman is not allowed to be a queen, he does bring that, but then when he talks about how the position of malchus goes to the children of the king, he says, oh, this is not only true with respect to the position of malchus, but it's true with respect to any position of authority. So Rav Moshe points out that while Rav Moshe expanded the discussion when appropriate to any position of authority later in the same halacha, later in the same mitzvah, nonetheless, when the Sefer HaChinuch was talking about the exclusion of a woman from being a melech, he did not extend it to other positions of authority, indicating that this limitation does not extend, in fact, to other positions of authority. Furthermore, Rav Moshe in the subsequent Shuvah points out that you could also bring a proof from the fact in the next halacha, when the Sefer HaChinuch talks about the fact that a convert can't be a king, so the Sefer HaChinuch goes further, as the Gemara does, and indicates that it's the exclusion of Mikarev Achecha, that it says that the king has to be appointed from amongst those who were born Jewish. It's the way it's understood by Chazal, that this exclusion of a ger, that a convert, that he can't be a king, extends to any position of authority, that a ger is not allowed to serve at any position of authority. Of course, that's Mefurish, that's very explicit in the Gemara, in Maseches Kiddushin Daf Ayin Vav, so we know that this is true as a matter of halacha. So the fact that the Sefer HaChinuch, when talking about a ger, extends the exclusion from being a king to any other position of authority, but does not extend this exclusion when he talks about the exclusion with respect to a woman, is further proof that the Sefer HaChinuch understood that it's limited to the position, the appointment of a woman to the position exclusively of being the queen, of being the monarch over the nation, but not to other positions of authority. So says Rav Moshe, that given that the Sefer HaChinuch seems to disagree, and then he tries to show that Rashi and Tosus and the Ran and the Rosh and the Ramban, he thinks, also disagree with the Rambam. He says that there are lots and lots of Rishonim that he thinks disagrees with the Rambam. So therefore, if you have a dire situation like here, where the woman really was a God-fearing woman who needed a parnasa, that there's room to be lenient. In other words, that sometimes the Torah itself builds in a certain amount of flexibility. It builds in a certain amount of wiggle room, that in a dire situation, one could potentially appoint a woman to a position of authority. He says this is certainly the case. Even according to the Rambam, this would certainly be the case if the only person who was God-fearing, who was able to do the job, was a woman, and you didn't have a man for a position, for that particular position of authority. It says that in order to appoint anybody to a position of authority, the most important qualification is that they be a Yorei Shemayim and a Shomer Mitzvos. But if you have a choice between a male apikoros of a woman who has Yorei Shemayim, so he says, so even according to the Rambam, of course, there's no question that you would appoint the woman in such circumstances. But he finally says that in the event that you have a way of being able to fulfill what the Rambam rules, namely that a woman shouldn't be appointed to any position of authority and still be able to accommodate a very pressing situation, so then he says, Mechwachin, that you're obligated to do both, because you can't ignore the Shita of the Rambam. The Rambam, after all, is the Rambam, and therefore we have to account for the Rambam's position. So his suggestion in the end is that they would work out such an arrangement where there would be a Rav who's officially in charge, a ceremonial Mashgiach who's a real, who is the official person who is in charge of the Hashgacha operation, and the woman, the Amana, would be port to this Rav. But really, the Amona would do all of the work, since she knows the business, she knows the trade, she knows when to ask or when not to ask and so forth, and the Rav would trust her, so really she would be doing the bulk of the work and she would be getting the bulk of the payment. But in terms of the way that the system would be officially set up, there would be a Rav who would be in charge of her, And therefore, one would avoid the problems of Sarawa according to the Shita of the Rambam. So this is significant because Rav Moshe does say that if you do have a way out of a situation in which one could accommodate the Shita of the Rambam, then one has a real obligation to do so. That he's not dismissing the Rambam. I once heard Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal speak about this subject. He said as well, you have to always reckon with the Shita of the Rambam whenever you enter into a discussion of this sort. Even if there is wiggle room to say that there are other Rishonim who may have disagreed with the Rambam, and that's something that can be taken into consideration, you have to reckon with the Rambam. But Moshe says you have an actual chiyuv, that if you have the ability to address a certain situation where it's really helpful to a particular community, or where it's very, very important for this particular woman to be appointed to a certain position, but you can do it in a way in which there is a Rav who is officially, say, even ceremonially, formally, in charge of her, so that's the way that you would be obligated to set up the system in order to avoid the problem of Sarara. The editor of the Hamaor Journal wrote a letter to Rav Moshe saying you're going to destroy the Mesorah of Klal Yisrael through your tshuva, because now, based on your tshuva, now in Israel, they're going to appoint a woman to be president or prime minister. This is before Golda Meir became prime minister. So Rav Moshe said, what are you worried about? First of all, I decided in accordance with Torah. If you are saying that I should avoid deciding according to Torah, so you're the one who's guilty here because you're superimposing values. Sometimes the values can be more reactionary, believe it or not, than what is required by the Torah. The values of Western civilization sometimes are much more strict regarding certain matters than Torah. But we don't guide ourselves by whatever the mores are of Western civilization at any point in time, bein l'kula, bein l'chumra, whether it's a more conservative or whether it's more liberal. We guide ourselves, says Rav Moshe, solely by what's in the Torah. The Torah indicates that there's a machlokis Rishonim with respect to this issue, and that most Rishonim don't hold like the Rambam, so therefore it's appropriate for us to take that into consideration. Further, says Rav Moshe, if you would have a decision made by the government of Israel that they want to appoint a woman to be prime minister, it's not as if they would be consulting my tshuvos before making that decision. It says they don't call us up when it comes to questions of kashrus, when it comes to questions of Shmira Shabbos, or when it comes to questions of anything else, so I don't expect that they would call us up about this. Lemaisa, they do whatever they want. So he was realistic about to what degree people were consulting his tshuvos in different places and in different spheres of authority. He said that's not something that we need to be terribly concerned about. But then he says something interesting. He says, and as far as the concern that maybe they'll appoint a woman to be president of a shul, so he says, okay, so when it comes to that particular question, for sure, people will consult with the Mara D'Asra of the community, and they will see that the Rambam is of the opinion shelodim nos isha, not to appoint a woman to any position of authority. So that's something that will be a guiding force for them. Does that mean Rav Moshe was paskining? This is dicta. That wasn't the question that he was deciding upon. So that's what we call dicta in legal parlance. It was just something that he mentioned in passing. Does that mean that Rav Moshe was paskining that a woman shouldn't be president of a shul? That he was saying a moradaso will take the Rambam into account. So it could be both. Very difficult to say for sure. The Rav Soloveitchik thought that a woman serving as president of a shul was problematic. That's a Kabbalah that I heard a number of times directly from Rav Shechter Shlita, that he felt that was a violation of Sarara. But it could be that the Rav was also being consistent because the Rav had a more expansive understanding of Sarara in general when it came to women. Because the Rav, this is published in the Shiurim of the Rav on Yoredeya, that Rabbi Konigsberg, Shlita, put out, where the Rav Soloveitchik was trying to explain the first halacha in Yoredeya, in Siman Aleph, that a woman's allowed to shecht. According to the strict halacha, anybody is allowed to shecht, including a woman, meaning men or women, both are allowed to perform shechita. However, the Ramah brings down that the minhag is that women don't shecht, because we haven't seen that women shecht. So the Shach says, he brings a kasha that was asked by the Sefer Agur, Lo Reinu Eino Raya, that if you don't see that something is done, that's not necessarily a proof that it's aser. So he says, no, but when it comes to minhagim, we do say Lo Reinu is a raya. If something hasn't been done, if it's a minhag, so then the fact that something hasn't been done on that can establish a minug. So the Rav said, what's going on over here? What is this all about? So Rav Soloveitchik explained that it used to be that Shechita was performed by everybody just within their own backyard. That's why the Sefer Kolbo even says, we draw a distinction that Nashim Shechtin La'atzma, that women can shecht for themselves. One possible interpretation is, yeah, they're just shechting not in as a public position in their own backyard. But then things changed, and the entire communal structure changed, where the shochtim no longer were just every single person shechting their own chickens, but there were official people appointed as shochtim. In fact, in many communities, what was considered to be the most important position was that of the shochet, even more so than the rav. Because, okay, a drasha, you could, you know, either take or leave. You couldn't go to the early minyan and miss the drasha altogether. But food, everybody has to eat meat. So therefore, it was a very, very big deal to have a shochet in the community. That became a position, a minoy, a public appointment. Not necessarily public authority. A shochet could be subject to halachic oversight, but it was a public appointment. So Rabbi Soloveitchik held that as opposed to, say, gerim, converts, who are not allowed to have a position of sarara, where they would have public authority, but to appoint a ger as a shochet, okay, so you could appoint a ger to a position, but when it comes to women, the exclusion of women from authority is a broader exclusion, because it applies not merely to a position of public authority, but to any kind of a public appointment, any type of a minoy. Now, where did he get this from? What would be the basis for this? So I would suggest that the basis would be that we're understanding some sort of a tam, we're understanding some sort of a reason, a consideration with respect to this exclusion of the women from svara positions, that it's based on an expansion of the role of the woman as being the epitome of the value of kol kibud debas melach panim, of the value of tznius, that the women more than men are expected to preserve this value of tznius, and therefore any kind of a public appointment in the sphere of the avodas hakodesh of the community is a potential dilution of this tznius role that is expected of women. And therefore, that's why we would say that even any type of public appointments, even if it's not in the form of an actual exercise of authority, would be problematic according to the understanding of Rav Soloveitchik. Rabbi Konigsberg mentions in a footnote that there's a possibility that we would nonetheless carve out a different type of exception to the exception, namely that it could be that if there is a group, an irgun, an organization of women, that it would not be viewed by the Rav as problematic for a woman to be in charge of that organization. Think of a woman being a headmistress of a women's school or something of that sort, because of the fact that maybe the svara only exists if it's in the larger communal sphere, as opposed to whether the svara is a svara just over other women. Now, getting back to svara, imenu, maybe that could be an explanation of the medrash as well, that there is such a thing as what we would call the svara of svara. There is such a thing as there being an authority that's appropriate for women according to Torah tradition. It could be that that authority has to be circumscribed by the norms and the values of tznius. So, of course, it's always been the woman's role to be the akeres habayis, to be the mainstay of the house, to be the person who instills the values of a Torah and mitzvot in the people of the house, who spurs her husband and her children to greater levels of Torah observance. That certainly constitutes a role of authority that's exercised by women, but it's exercised more in the private sphere. It's exercised within the bias. In the bias, the woman's in charge. Her husband's obligated, you know, to be mechabit his wife, yotzei migufo. He has to be mechabit her more than himself. This is because the woman really is the mainstay of the house. She is an authority figure within the house. It could be also that in other types of private spheres as well, when dealing with a women's institution, a women's group, where it's appropriate for a woman to play that type of a role. So perhaps in the same way that the Rav expanded the nature of the role to any position of appointment, even if it doesn't contain actual authority, that same consideration could also lead to the permissibility and even the encouragement of serving in Sarara type roles within the more private sphere of the home and within the organizations and groups that are confined to women as well. Yes?
I believe before when we were talking about the Rambam, you said that even the Rambam would take a shot at Chak, that a woman, and the shot at Chak, where like, I think you said Al-Karas or whatever, the woman could be in the position of Svara. If the Rambam would think it's like a din the right side, why would shot at Chak matter at all?
Oh, I don't know the Shasat Chak, but Moshe writes that it's simply just the question of if I don't have anybody else who's available to do the job, meaning that this is, he says this, to be fair, I mean, we could go to the source. My interpretation is, he's saying it even within the Rambam, I don't know if that's the terminology that Rav Moshe uses. The terminology Rav Moshe uses is as follows. He says, hold on one second. If you look in the materials on page 5 of the materials, the fifth line down, Baror, and it's clear, Shemizdamin be'ezamakam shirotzim limnos le'ezam minoy rak o ishu kofer v'alaveiros. You want to appoint somebody who is either a kofer v'alaveiros o isha kashera v'efsha lipo shelo yimnu shumekon me'an, and you need to have somebody el ish kasher, and there is no ish kasher available. Shebadai sarak l'sayeya sheyimnu es ha'isha kashera v'lo es ha'isha kofer v'arosha. And obviously you would need to have the isha kashera and not the isha rasha, who's the kofer and the rasha. Maybe this is as well. It sounds to me like this would be even according to the Rambam. I'm just to be clear. You know, that's the language of Ramosha. Yeah. I want to be clear about his language. What the Svara would be is that I have no choice but to appoint the position altogether because it's necessary for Klal Yisrael. The work has to get done. So then I could say maybe it's not an appointment at all. You know, Ramosha has this, I believe, with respect to Shmaya Bavtalion. They were Gerim. According to the Rambam's understanding, for sure they were actual gerim, and that they served in the Sanhedrin, and would appear that a ger would be disqualified from serving on the Sanhedrin. Serve in other capacities of Dine Mamonos, but in the Sanhedrin, it would appear that a ger would be disqualified. So how could they have served in that capacity? So a bunch of different answers that are given. One answer I think that he mentions, this is in Yoredeya, Chelek Dalet Siman Chavav, is that they were not necessarily appointed. It's just that there was nobody else there. They were so good, and it was such big time, and they could come. It was obvious they had to serve in this capacity. It wasn't a question of appointment. It's kind of like they're there. So you can make perhaps the similar argument over here. If there's nobody else, so nobody else available, you're not necessarily, you know, appointed per se. I always, you know, tell that joke when I took over as the director of the Beis Din of America, that the person who was there before we were just kind of getting off the ground in terms of revitalizing ourselves as an institution. This goes back to 1997, 1998. So the person who was there before me decided they were going to go back to their job as a law professor, and as a result, the position was vacant. I was serving as a volunteer in the office up until then, so since there was nobody else there, I just changed the station every night, made myself director. So, you know, didn't have to be appointed per se. I mean, the truth is, I really was appointed as well, but that's the joke that I tell. But that's really, even if I wasn't appointed, I probably could have just done that, and nobody would have objected. Because the mice say, if you're the only one there, b'makom she'enish, you know, then ishtadel yosisha. So there's nobody who's appropriately qualified, then you have to just step into the breach. But it's not necessarily. But the argument might be that it wouldn't necessarily even be viewed as an appointment per se. There's in the Halakha Yomis, which is a website that is devoted to the psakim of Avadi Yosef. You find something similar that is quoted apparently in the name of Avadi Yosef, where he also says in connection with Arosh HaMemshalah, being a prime minister of Israel. So this would appear to come much closer to even the main limud that we derive from the pasuk of Melech Velo Malka. So right, because this would be as close as we come to some type of a malchus type of position of a rosh hamemshala bizman hazeh. And Rav Avadya Yosef says with respect to that, that exactly along the lines of what Rav Moshe had said, that if you did not have somebody who was a Yari Shemayim, other than a woman, and all the other candidates were men who were kofrim, so he writes, that there's nobody else who's going to strengthen the Torah observance of the state of Israel more than a particular woman candidate, then for sure we would have to support the election of the female candidate for that position. So he also subscribes to the same notion. Okay, and now sometimes a question can arise. Yes?
If I could just add, I don't want to, but someone has told me that the Soloveitchik also went with this reasoning of Rav Moshe Ashir, that he said the same thing, that Lo Yatsa by Shmaya Natalia, that Lo Matsa Yatsa
in Oh, so you're, okay. So
Soloveitchik also said this logic.
So he also said the same logic.
Yeah, yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Very good. Right.
Shabbat's already said in Pirkei Avos, he says that Shabbat.
Yeah, he says something similar. It's quoted by the Baalei Tosfos. Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah. That's right, that's right. Okay, very good, very good. The question becomes, if we don't follow that specific gedder or delineation of the Rav, that any position of appointment is automatically sororin and has to be one of actual authority, so where do you draw the line in terms of what constitutes authority? So some claim that being president of the shul doesn't really contain any authority, I mean, besides the fact that it's, abdus of the most extreme form in terms of the bizyonos that a president normally has to take, but even in terms of the halakhic definition of sroa, some say that a president of a shul can't always take actions on his own, but it has to consult with the body, has to consult with the board, has various people who have to approve before something can get done. So if that's the nature of the president's authority, so of Dov Brisman, who's the Abbezdin in Philadelphia, wrote an essay arguing that a ger, that a convert, could be president of the shul, of a shul, especially if a shul operates in such a fashion where the president doesn't have any unilateral authority, but always has to do everything in consultation with the vod. So this question has come up from time to time, and there have been certain poskim, like Rav Gedalia Dov Schwarzschlitter, who have apparently said that in certain situations, when it's appropriate for a community to have a woman appointed to a president because of the dynamics of the community and because and where it's a situation where the president doesn't have any unilateral authority, that under those circumstances it could be considered for a woman to serve as a president of a congregation. Others feel, as I quote in the name of Rav Schechter, that the Rav apparently held not so, but that would be consistent of the Rav's opinion that it might not necessarily depend upon authority altogether. And others have said, like the late Rav Aaron Felder, who was the previous Abbezdin, Zatzal was the previous Abbezdin in Philadelphia, he said that he doesn't think it's really true. He thinks that there are lots of things. When you're president, even if you're supposed to consult, it doesn't mean you always do consult, right? We know that's true of presidents of all kinds of institutions, organizations, and even countries. Once you're president, so what's the expression? It's good to be king, it's good to be president. So you could sometimes end up doing lots of things on your own without full-fledged consultation. And therefore, he was not as sanguine about this particular dispensation with respect to a ger. Some, I think, were also concerned if you allow it with a ger, who knows what will happen next, you allow it with a woman. But as I said, it might not necessarily be the end of the world. All of this really depends on consultation with appropriate poskim, like Schwartz, people of the appropriate stature. I think that the Frimmers wrote an article about this a little while ago, Rav Arya of Dover Frimmer, who also wrote recently about partnership minyanim kayudua. So they wrote about this subject. They said that they consulted with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, that's out, and Rav Aaron said that you shouldn't storm the barricades over this issue. So he didn't necessarily say that it was permissible, but he said you shouldn't storm the barricades, whatever that means. But presumably it means that there is a little bit of wiggle room in terms of, number one, reckoning with the Rambam and those who disagree with the Rambam, looking at the mechanics and dynamics of the community, and figuring out also whether the role of president in any particular community is a role that is circumscribed by a need to consult with others, or whether it's one that gives a more unilateral and absolute type of authority, and that could vary from community to community. Rabbi Bleich wrote an article on the subject in which he said that certainly serving on a board he did not think was particularly problematic, because he said that's just a minoy shel kavod. Somebody's put on the board, so that's just kind of like an honorary position. Board members don't necessarily have any power whatsoever. They're just invited to the meetings to show up, but usually there are a few people who are really in charge. So maybe if you're one of those few people who are really in charge, so then that could be an issue. But otherwise, he said that being a board member might be much less problematic in terms of this sorority issue. But one thing is clear, And that is that learning Torah, when we talk about Talmud Torah, a Talmud Torah connection for women, that's something which I think we would view as a very appropriate thirst. The person has a thirst for Torah. You have women nowadays who are sitting and who want to be able to become tremendously learned in Torah. So that's something which probably is which I believe is certainly a good thing. It's much better for a woman to thirst to become knowledgeable in Torah than to leave the fold or have no interest in Torah whatsoever. If this is going to help a woman impart those values to her children, to her students, to future generations, to build up in terms of our own personal connection with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. So that's something which Rav Soloveitchik certainly encouraged, and I believe that we all institutionally and personally encourage as well. The question there is, what do you do with the Gemara in Sota that indicates that anybody who teaches his daughter Torah is teaching her Tiflus, is teaching her promiscuity on some level, that this way she'll be able to see that, it's possible to perhaps commit certain averus, and yet if somebody commits adultery and she has certain zechuyos, so those zechuyos will keep her going, like the Gemara in Sota says, for a period of time, so maybe there's a certain amount of tiflus involved. If somebody learns Torah but maybe only learns a certain amount, or is able to take Torah to utilize for nefarious purposes, so here it's important to know that when this, number one, the Mishnah and the Gemara in Sota, this is a Mishnah and Daf Chof and Aleph, the Gemara and Daf Chof Aleph and Beis, that the Mishnah there records, first of all, it's a Machlokis, there's one opinion that says that you're obligated to teach your daughter Torah, okay, so even if we don't hold like that opinion, we hold like Rabbi Elazar, says, nonetheless, the way it's not stated as an absolute prohibition, and the way in which it's codified in the Shulchan Aruch is that there are already three exclusions that appear in the Shulchan Aruch, all based on the formulation in the Gemara. One is that the limitation is only Shlo Yilamed Adam Esbito Torah, a person shouldn't teach his daughter Torah. So that does not rule out the possibility that if a woman is motivated on her own, and she indicates that she wants to learn Torah on her own, that's something that it could be perfectly permissible and even encouraged, and that's how the Prisha ruled in his commentary to the Torah. Number two, the Rambam says that this is technically only Torah Shebaal Peh. That's an absolute prohibition, but teaching Torah Shebiktav is not an absolute prohibition. So generations later, the Chafetz Chaim said that there wasn't a need to specifically teach in an organized curriculum Torah Shebiktav to women when they learn these values at home. But he said already in his generation, this is the Chafetz Chaim Likutei Halachos and Sota, he said that they're not necessarily picking up the values at home. Many are leaving home, they're being exposed to other values, so we need to have established schools for women, and thus there was an imprimatur that was placed by the Chafetz Chaim on the Beis Yaakov movement. So we see that here, even the way in which the halacha was codified allowed for a certain amount of wiggle room. And third, the halacha as it is codified in the Shulchan Aruch, this is in the Shulchan Aruch, Simen Reish Mem Vav, Sif Vav, and Yoredeya, also says that Chayevis Haisha, that a woman is obligated to, you have to teach laws that are applicable to women. So therefore, one argument that is made, you'll find this among the various family members of Rav Soloveitchik, because Rav Soloveitchik wrote a letter in which he said that he thinks it's imperative that in our yeshiva curriculum, this is a letter that he wrote in 1953 to Rabbi Leonard Rosenfeld, who was then the head of the BJE, I think, the Board of Jewish Education. He said he thinks that Torah Shebaal Peh should be taught equally to women and to men, and the reasoning, as it was fleshed out by others, was that, and as the Rav indicated also in his language, was that if a woman was not exposed to the same high level of rigor in her learning, then she might become disenchanted with her education and she might become less committed. So therefore, this falls into the category of what we would call the mandatory teaching of Torah. So Rabbi Twersky, Shlita distinguishes between the optional, where there were certain limitations placed on optional teaching of Torah to women, and mandatory teaching of Torah to women. So when a woman will not reach the requisite level of commitment in Yiras Shemayim and desire and to transmit those values to future generations, unless she's learning Torah on the same high level to which she's exposed to secular education, and therefore really needs to learn Torah Shebaal Peh the same way the boys are being taught Torah Shebaal Peh. So then, under those circumstances, it becomes mandatory. So really, in this regard, we see that the halacha itself provides, this is why we are so incredibly in awe of the timeless nature of the Torah teachings, that the Torah itself, in its incorporation of this halakha, allowed for the various avenues that would enable Torah to be taught at higher levels to women when the circumstances and when the realities of the time really require it. So it's not at all in conflict, and it's not a change at all in terms of the principles of the Torah, but it's an application of the principles of Torah to the modern realities. And therefore, that's considered to be a very good thing. When women are motivated to learn Torah on their own, they don't receive the same schar as the men who are commanded to learn Torah, but with respect to that which they're commanded, obviously they receive the schar, and with respect to everything else, they do receive some measure of schar, enu mitzuva ve'osa, and if it draws them closer in their commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so then it becomes not merely optional, but it becomes mandatory to the degree that it's necessary for them to receive this education in order to be inspired to be able to maintain their commitment and to transmit their commitment to future generations. Somebody had their hand up. Okay, so then the question becomes, what should she do with this knowledge? So she has this knowledge, so first of all, obviously she uses it for her own connection with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, and certainly it's appropriate for her to teach the Torah within the private sphere to her children and the like, but is there a public role that's appropriate for the women who are able to acquire this high level of Torah? So here, I just would, you know, clarify one issue I think that is very much almost like a distraction that is created with the obsession of the discussion regarding women rabbis. I think smicha is something which is much more specialized and which is much more specific in its scope. In the sense that smicha, if you look at the formulation of the Rambam in Hilchos Sanhedrin, is really an extension of dayanus. That in order for a person to be a dayan, they would have to receive smicha, and then they were, as the Rambam puts it, they would be able to be called rebbe, they could be called rabbi, and then they could judge even dine knossos, they would be in the framework of a dayan. A woman, as we know, is a discussion, and can a woman be a dayan or not? So it's a paskin in the it's paskin in the Gemara. A woman can't be a dayan because a woman can't be an aid can't be a dayan. Yerushalmi is even more explicit about it, but it's in the Shulchan Aruch, it certainly makes it unequivocal. There's no dissenting opinion, Isha Psula Ladun, that you say it's Xeris Akosov, Amdu Shnei Anashim, Shem Lehem, Harib Lepnei Hashem, Anashim Velo Nashim, women can't be Edim, it's Xeris Akosov, and anybody, Koshenu Koshel, Lahayed, Enu Koshel Ladun, somebody who can't be an aid, can't be a Dayan, whatever the nature of the Xeris Akosov, a woman is excluded from being a Dayan. Since Smicha is really a continuation of the institution of Dayanus, even the smicha nowadays, which is essentially an Atilas Rishutz, it's not the original smicha of Moshe Rabbeinu, the Rambam writes that this is true of smicha l'dor, smicha for all generations. This is the idea of what smicha stands for. Why do we even have an imitation smicha, that we have smicha even though the original smicha of Moshe Rabbeinu lapsed? So smicha today, even though it stands for more the notion that this person is authorized, that they are able to transmit Torah faithfully and clearly, and that they have been so authorized by their Rebbeim, but it's a continuation. We maintain the title because it's a continuation of the original smicha. That's why Tosfos applies the principle of shlichusayu de kamaika of dinan, that we are shluchim, we're the agents in time of those who are the original musmachim, those who had originally received smicha. That's why the Aruch HaShulchan, the Shu'a Saramah, they apply the principles that were applicable to the original smicha to current day smicha as well, that we don't give the specialized smicha that a person is only able to paskin on with respect to certain very limited matters if they do not have a broader smicha as well, that they are more learned, that if they are learned in the general in the entirety of Torah, at least on some fundamental level. So all of these different considerations are based on the recognition that the smicha that we have today, the fact that we perpetuate these titles of rabbi and rav and so forth, are meant to be a hemshik, they're meant to be a continuation of the original smicha, which was completely tied in inextricably to the qualification to be able to serve as a dayan. The whole question came up a number of decades ago. Rabbi Chalap Shlita mentioned to me once that he had a conversation with Rav Soloveitchik about whether he could give smicha to geirim, because after all, geirim are excluded from srara. So can a ger be appointed as a musmok? So Rav Soloveitchik said, well, we find the Rabbi Avraham Ger is mentioned in the Tosos and Kiddushin, so we see the geirim had received smicha in the past, so you could give smicha to geirim. So the question is, what about the concern of dayanuskin? Isn't a ger excluded from being able to serve as a dayan? So the reality is that the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that hakol ksherim ladan, where it says that everybody is qualified to serve as a dayan, lasu yeger, that comes to include a ger. So a ger is not excluded from the framework of dayanus. There are certain limitations within the framework of dayanus as to when a ger can serve as a dayan and when a ger cannot serve as a dayan. But fundamentally, a ger is included within the framework of dayanus. You don't find that at all with respect to a woman. That's why even with respect to a bezdin of hataras nedarim, where the standards are lesser in terms of who can serve as a dayan for that bezdin, Rabbi Kiva Eger says that although krovim are kosher, you could have relatives of such a bezdin, you can't have women. Why can't you have women for a bezdin of hataras nedarim? Because they're completely excluded from the framework of serving as a dayan. Yes.
Do these issues of Sora apply to secular positions, for instance, a woman being a judge in a secular court?
Not necessarily, because this is all within the framework of what we would call Avodas HaKodesh. In other words, these are the positions that are created by the Torah within the Torah community. Now, it would be applicable to a position of authority with respect to the Jewish community. You know, the Gemara in Kiddushin talks about Sarara positions in terms of a person being in charge of directing the water from the wells, as to who should receive how much water from the wells, of being in charge of weights and measurements. So certainly within the organized Jewish community, it's understood as being applicable in those types of roles. I don't think that it's necessarily carried out from a secular perspective in terms of the secular world, because the secular world operates according to, you know, its own principles. Sarara really means Sarara over the Jewish community. That's what we're talking about. I mean, that's just kind of like my visceral answer to your question, but I think that that's really what the sources are focused upon.
Would there be an issue for her to say sit in judgment between two Jewish
That's a separate thing. It would be an issue. There might be an issue for a male judge to sit in judgment over two Jewish parties who are coming in front of a secular court when they're supposed to be in front of a bezdin. That's not specifically a female issue. That's more a positional issue. Somebody who serves in that position has to, you know, deal with that problem in general. Okay. Now the question is that even when you take out the serving as a rav from the equation, which I think in certain ways is a red herring, because it really distracts the discussion, since it's a very, very specific type of position that I believe Lefia Nias Daiti is off limits for women simply based on its very strong connection to Dayanus. The question is, what about other types of roles? So here, this is where the OU statement, you know, tried to address this type of issue. Are there roles that we would say are still maybe appropriate for women to serve, even if we acknowledge that there are very specific problems in connection with the smicha itself? So here, you have to recognize that this is also a moving target, or it's an evolving picture. It really depends to some degree on the needs of the community. We don't create roles. We don't create public roles if there isn't a pressing need in general, and that's based on our commitment as a community to norms of tznius. Even Moshe Rabbeinu resisted for 7 days being selected by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself to be the leader of Klal Yisrael, because it's not viewed as a desideratum to necessarily serve in such a capacity altogether. So one has to determine to what degree are there positions that are really very important to the people. So, for example, take kala teachers. So here, this is where norms of tznius actually militate specifically in the direction of having women rather than men. If you had a man who would be teaching all of the laws of Nida to a woman, is this a certain tension in terms of the principles of Tznius for a man to be too explicit and too detailed when he's having that type of discussion for women? So here the institution of having something like a Kala teacher is very appropriate, even if I viewed it as an appointment. You know, for someone to be a Kala teacher, I could say this is the Svara of Sara, that would be an appropriate role, and even a preferred role for women to be able to serve in that capacity. It's very interesting, the very same person who wrote the fiery letter to Rav Moshe, the editor of the journal HaMa'or, protesting against Rav Moshe's leniency when it came to a woman serving as a mashkika and how one can entertain opinions other than the Rambam, the very same person wrote another fiery essay that's published in Encyclopedia HaMa'or. There's actually an English encyclopedia of various HaMa'or articles, and you'll find this essay in that volume. And he wrote a fiery letter about this newfangled institution of women kala teachers. So there's a whole bit of kala teachers. He said he doesn't understand why we're going against what had always been done. You didn't have these special kala teachers. A woman wanted to know about laws of Nida, she would speak to her mother-in-law, her father-in-law. That's how, you know, she would find out the right things to do and how to go about living life in accordance with Hilchos Nida. Now you have these interlopers who are coming into the picture and are telling her all kinds of things that might not be exactly the same thing that her father-in-law would have told her. Therefore, this is a terrible institution, and we have to take steps against it. So that was not the opinion that was ultimately accepted. We have kala teachers all over the place, and it's viewed as something which is a very, very positive thing. So we've always had evolving debate when it comes to these various positions. People don't necessarily realize that. But this is a healthy thing, as long as it's being done in accordance with Torah considerations and Torah principles. So the distinction that the OU formulated was that women should not serve as clergy. This is an extension, again, of the discussion about smicha, both in terms of title and in terms of performance of clergy functions. And they brought us various examples, bris milah, baby naming, weddings and funerals, sermons from the pulpit during services, leading minyanim, various things that are generally reserved to a person who has the title of rabbi. And therefore, serving in that function would be essentially providing this type of title, this type of a status to the women, and would run afoul of these other considerations of Sarara and Sneos and the Mesorah of what we've done within our community. However, what they felt that you could draw the line is to be a teacher. Certainly being a teacher is a very, very fine thing. My wife has always been known over the years as Mora Mindy, right? Okay, people can testify firsthand. That's certainly something which is a very, very proud title that women have always occupied, to be a teacher. I think that's what Nechama Leibovitz placed on her matzeva. It says Mora, right? I think it's like a one-word epitaph on her matzeva. It says Mora. Something that women are very, very proud of being able to occupy and serve as teachers of children. Certainly women teaching in the role of Torah teachers for young children has always been a very, very appropriate role. The OU went further to speak about scholar in residence and even being able to speak at various events, serving as executive director for programming, manager, administrative roles, as an administrative role, serving as an administrator within the functioning of a synagogue as well. So they felt that all of these types of roles, since they do not run afoul of Tznius concerns, and they do not run afoul of Sarara concerns. Generally, if one is serving as, let's say, an administrative role in the executive functioning of a shul, they're subject, obviously, to the rabbinic leadership of the shul and so forth. They're not serving in a rabbinic capacity, so they felt that those things would be perfectly fine. I don't have the perfect formula, to be perfectly honest with you, about where one draws the lines with respect to the different roles. I could say rabbis off limits because of the fact that's a violation of the meaning and definition of smicha as being an extension of dayanus. But what I will say is that what the OU was doing in trying to make this type of determination and drawing these demarcation lines was engaging in the analysis that the poskim have to engage in, which is taking into consideration all of these different concerns, the Svara concerns, the Shita of the Rambam, the Tznius concerns about Kokavud Vas Malach Panima. We paskin based on Tznius, right? We paskin the halacha that Amoni below Amonis, Moavi below Moavis, according to the Gemara and Yevamos. That's based on Tznius concerns, because the question was posed, why is it that we are not allowed to intermarry with some a male from Moab or Ammon who converts to Judaism? So the answer is because they acted improperly when Bnei Yisrael passing through their land. They didn't offer them food and drink, so they didn't have the basic Jewish values and basic character traits of what it takes to be a member of Klal Yisrael and to intermarry within Klal Yisrael after Geirus, even after Geirus. So the Gemara says, but why punish the so why not then extend that to the women as well? So the Gemara answers, because kokabuda bas melech penima, because the it was not, we don't penalize the Ammoni women, and therefore we allow them, like Ruth, who converted to Judaism, was allowed to get married. Why was she allowed to get married? Because of the fact that it was only the men who could be penalized for not going out and providing food and water, because it's only appropriate for the men to go out, but it's not appropriate, you can't expect women to go out, because kol kavuda bas melech penima. So the Gemara asked, no, I would have thought that at least the women could go out for the women's. We say, no, when it comes out to anything, when it comes to being in the public sphere, so we say, kol kavuda bas melech penima is an overriding, all-encompassing idea. And therefore, that's why we say that it is the women were not similarly punished like the men were to be permanently prohibited from getting married within the Jewish community should they convert to Judaism. So we see that the Gemara itself invokes this principle of kol kavuda bas melech penima to actually establish a halacha. This is the halacha that enabled Ruth to marry Boaz and enabled David eventually generations later to be born from such a union, that the actual melech and king leader of Klal Yisrael, the Davidic dynasty, which is the Malchus based David that will bring about the Mashiach, this was all established from a recognition of and an application halakhically of this principle of kol kavuda bas melech penima. So obviously that's something that would have to be reckoned with. Yes?
Doesn't that Gemara end off with it's like Zera from Shmuel as opposed to...
No, the Gemara ends up by saying that this is based on the principle of kokavuda bas melech penima. So the Gemara said, we asked the Kasha, the Nashim should have gone out to greet the Nashim, you know, so that it's a, because the Gemara starts off by saying that it's the derech ha'ish, you know, to go out to men, but not the derech of women to go out to men. So the Gemara says, no, the Nashim should have greeted the Nashim. So the Gemara concludes by saying, no, because of kokavuda bas melech penima, even that wouldn't have been appropriate. That's a muskana. Take a look at the sugya. That's the Gemara. That's how the Gemara ends. All right. So so this is and finally, who is suited to make these types of determinations? Obviously, the sources do provide a certain amount of fungibility, but they also provide for certain bright lines. And who is equipped to be able to draw those bright lines and determine the sphere of applicability? So you need the Gedolei Yisrael. That's why the Chafetz Chaim was consulted when it came to the question of establishing formal women's education. That's why you need a gadol with the broad shoulders of Rav Soloveitchik to determine the parameters of teaching Torah Sheba'al Peh to women today. And even with the Rav's psak, not everybody felt that it was appropriate for every single community to institute Torah Sheba'al Peh in every single girl's school curriculum. This is also something which is dependent upon what the needs are in any particular school, in any particular community, based on the dynamics of the situation. So therefore, certainly it is an appropriate exercise to have this type of consultation with the halakhic experts to try to draw these lines. And how you draw them at any point in time will depend very much on the dynamics of the community. One area where there is a continued sensitivity is with respect to the Yoatzot Halakha program. So what's the issue over here? It's sort of a double issue. One is to what degree, if a woman is trained to be a yuetza talaka, to help to guide women with respect to taras and mishpacha. So does that violate any of the categories or norms that we've discussed? So from a tzniyas perspective, certainly when it comes to matters of taras and mishpacha, it seems like it's entirely appropriate to have women be involved, as we have kala teachers, to be involved in providing that type of instruction, providing that type of access to other women. A concern that exists with respect to the yoetze talaka that some have noted is that it can't be done in a fashion in which the rav, who is supposed to be the posek of the community, is bypassed entirely. That might be a srara violation if she becomes kind of the sole authority on the subject, and then it also leads to the question of, can a woman be a posek? Can a woman be a posek is discussed a little bit by Tosfos. Tosfos asked the question, a woman can't be a dayan, so how was Shtevora able to serve as a shofetis? So Tosfos gives different answers in different places, and one answer Tosfos gives is that a woman, that Devora was appointed in Minashamayim as a special divine dispensation, but another answer Tosfos gives is that she wasn't paskening, she was just melamedis es adinim kadeshi adunu. She was teaching the dinim to the dayanim so they would know, she was whispering in their ear, so they would know how to pasken the cases. She was serving essentially as a yoetzit. So that would seem to, you know, give credence to this type of a role, but Tosfos is in Yevamos, is very, very clear. This is sheyadunu, in order that they would be the ones who are issuing the psak. So it sounds like that she had the ability to teach the dinim, but ultimately the psak had to be handed down by the dayon. So here as well, perhaps this is a way of structuring the position properly to make sure that it's always, if such a position is created, it's done in connection with the local rabbinic and communal leaders. That's in fact the way that the OU statement, you know, was formulated, so that they can make sure that they're comfortable with the hierarchy and they're comfortable with the structure. The next question is, can a woman really paskin in general? Is there, outside of there being a formal role that a woman plays, is there any kind of realm where it would be appropriate? So the Piskei Tshuva in Choshen Mishpat quotes from the Chidah, from the Birkei Yosef, who says, well, we can learn from the ruling of Tosfos that she was teaching them dinim. So we see from here that Isha Chachama Yechola Lahoros Hora, that from the fact that Devorah is Melamedes Lahem Dinim, so we see that assuming that you get out of the hierarchical problems in terms of a woman, if she's serving in some sort of a capacity, that she's subordinate to a rav of a community, but nonetheless the actual act of paskening itself, the chidah that we see from here is not considered to be problematic. In fact, the Sefer Achinuch, in sort of a very unusual context, we're talking about the prohibition of paskening shilas when you're drunk, says, oh, this applies to women as well. Said if you have an isha chachama haruiya lahoros, a woman who's a chachama who knows how to paskin, she shouldn't paskin when she's drunk. So kamash balan, if she's not drunk, she can paskin. So that's what the Sefer Achinuch seems to indicate. There was a Shari Tshuva quoted by the Piskei Tshuva as well. Piskei Tshuva is in Siman Zayin Choshen Mishpat that seems to limit it a little bit and says, well, maybe it just means that a woman has the ability to help establish what the facts are so that a psak can be made based on her determination of the facts. However, from the Chidah and from the Sefer Achinuch, it's clear that there is some realm in which a woman has the ability to paskin. The question is, with the creation of Yoad Zot, how do you draw the lines exactly? Because it's one thing for a woman to paskin in the privacy of her own home. She tells her children what bracha to make. Or even she tells her husband the laws of kashrus. She reminds him the laws of kashrus. Women very often are more knowledgeable than their husbands about the laws of kashrus because they're dealing with it all the time. Or you have a rebbetzin of a shul that in a sort of a discreet way she says, okay, I think I know this is the halakha, and she's certainly giving psaka for other women in the community and things of that sort, where you don't have these type of sneas concerns, you don't have these type of srara concerns, so one could understand why you would want a woman who's available for questions in the domain of taras hamishpacha in particular. But again, you have to be very, very careful, because according to the Rav, once you create any type of appointment, so that already implicates certain potential sorority issues according to the Rav. And even if you hold like the definition of sorority that would not necessarily extend to any appointment, but just the positions of authority, it's still very important to make sure that there's a Rav who's reviewing the process once you have an official appointment which is in place. So I had a conversation with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal shortly before he was Nifter, the summer before he was nifted. It's very interesting. I used to meet with him from time to time. I was told by the person who coordinated all the appointments for Rav Aaron that my meeting with Rav Aaron that summer was the last really substantive meeting that he was able to have, in which he was able to give Eitzah in a very sustained fashion. So I consider myself very zocher to have had that meeting at that time with Rav Aaron. But I asked him this question because people had asked me the question about the parameters of Yoatzot to the degree that it might be appropriate for a given community, as indicated in the OU statement now. So people said, so what about when it comes to Amara? Is it ever appropriate for somebody in that position to pass an Amara? And I thought that's an interesting question, because if you just look in a vacuum at the Chidah and the Sefer HaChinuch, so maybe you think one thing, but then again, you look in the Gemara and Nida and the Abchof, it talks about how Yilta had a certain question regarding Amara, and she showed it to some other Chacham, and the question is, why didn't she show it to her husband? There was a big Tamil Chacham, so then there's a discussion why she didn't show it to her husband. But Tosus asked that question. But one question nobody asks is, why didn't she just figure it out for herself? Given that she was Yilta. Yilta was, we know, a very, very learned woman. She was one of the major learned women who's described in the Gemara. So it wasn't clear to me that this was something, again, I couldn't tell you why the Gemara would specifically say the Paskening Maros would be off limits if there might be other areas of Sakh that could be appropriate, at least within a private sphere. But nonetheless, I decided that I would ask Rav Aaron Lichtenstein this question. So Rav Aaron responded to me, because Rav Aaron was known as somebody who was favorably disposed. It was the notion of Yoatzot. And Rav Aaron responded to me. He said, all the women that I know who are Yoatzot halacha are tremendously God-fearing women. So therefore, there's no question in my mind that they would never pass an Amara without showing it to a Rav. So I took from his answer that he felt that this was an appropriate protocol, that Amara should be brought over to Rabbanim. Again, this requires a Gadol B'Yisrael. It requires somebody who has the sensitivity of knowing the entire corpus of Torah, or somebody who understands the psakim that would indicate leniency in one direction, stringency in the other direction, and would have a sense of what we would call the ruach of the Torah, to know where you draw the lines. Rav Shechta talks about, Rav Shechta Shlita talks about, where it says, "Vanizos b'si'o sam uchiya shevalecha d'raya shesamti b'fika," that it is the dvar halacha and it is the ruach halacha. That you have to know where to draw the lines sometimes, not only based on assiduously going through the sources, but also viewing Torah in totality. Why does the Gemara speak about only men, only distinguished Rabbanim, David and Malach being up to his knees in blood, be looking at sacks and placentas in order to pass kinshilas for women? That there's a certain ruach halacha indicating that when it comes to certain types of shilas, they just can't be paskin without appropriate consultation with the Rabbanim. Now, when we've discussed all of these different matters up until now, one thing that has become clear is that one has to balance the sensitivities of the needs of the women who really are God-fearing and really want to expand their Yiras Shemayim, they want to grow in Talmud Torah, they want to be able to contribute to the community with an understanding of what are the halakhic parameters. The poskim have done this with respect to a huge sphere of shilos that have arisen over the centuries. I'll give just two paradigms before we start to wind up our discussion for today. One is in the realm of a Kaddish. Can a woman say Kaddish? The Chavos Yair wrote about this a few hundred years ago, and he said that strictly speaking, if a bas, he was speaking about a case where a man didn't leave any sons, and he wanted the daughter to say Kaddish. So could the daughter have there would be a minyan that would be arranged at home, would the woman be able to, would the daughter be able to say Kaddish under those circumstances? So he wrote, and that would be not a minyan, be more precise, that we're going to have a learning group. And after the learning group, she would say Kaddish. So Chavos Yair said that even though he had no specific reason to think that such a thing would be usher, and it could even be a toelas v'nachas ruach l'nefesh for a daughter to say Kaddish, just like a son would say Kaddish, he said that nonetheless, that mikol makom yesh lako shayadei kach yaklashu kolacham min hogim. You have to be worried that this is something that could weaken the strength of the minhagim. So we see that the notion of being concerned about Mesorah, Tzilach Mikrei Atzon, of following in the steps of our predecessors, predecessors, this is something that was always very much on the minds of the poskim who had to deal with these types of issues. Now, there were those who were more lenient than the Chavos Yad. There were those who were more stringent. They said, what are you talking about? Kaddish is a Davar Shebikdusha. So what the Minchas Yitzchak writes, it's a Davar Shebikdusha. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik writes that nowadays, he thinks that if it's a choice between either a woman saying Kaddish or the possibility of leaving the fold of Torah Judaism altogether, so then we have an obligation to allow a woman to say Kaddish because he feels that it's not strictly usher. Now, again, you needed Gedola Yisrael to come to that conclusion. And Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, who was considered to be the reigning posek in America before Rav Moshe came on the horizon, and then he was alongside Rav Moshe. So Rav Henkin wrote that he felt that if you have a woman who's furthering the legacy of her father or her mother, her parents in other ways, in terms of the way she dresses and the way she comports herself, and she also wants to accord an extra level of respect for the neshama by saying Kaddish, so then he says that under those circumstances, one could potentially be makel. He says the specific language that he used was, hold on, I just want to pull it out. There we go. He says something like, I'll pull it out, he says, Epsha Shein Kepeda. He says that it's possible that it's not going to be a problem. Now, if you're a gadol of the stature of Henkin and you say Epsher, you say that it's possible that it's not going to be a problem, so obviously you're opening up the floodgates, but he was prepared. He says Epsher Shein Kepeda, that's the exact lotion that he uses. So he was prepared to open up the floodgates, or to allow for that, because one, a posek has to exercise a certain level of sensitivity, a posek has to exercise a certain amount of wisdom to understand how harsh you're going to be at not permitting something which me'ikar din is going to be mutter, if it could bring about a greater sense of Yirah Shemayim, if it could bring about a greater sense of commitment to Torah principles. Similarly, with respect to Bat Mitzvah celebrations, so Moshe was more circumspect when it came to Bat Mitzvah celebrations, that he felt that Al Yishonim Anu Mitzdarim, that he doesn't like the Bat Mitzvah celebration so much, why should we allow Bat Mitzvah celebrations? A birthday party, fine, but more than that, he thought that none of all of the fanfare and the pomp and the ceremony was necessarily good for anybody's growth. But Rav Avayu Yosef wrote, certainly for the Sfardim, that he thought that it was something that they had as part of their tradition, and Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Sri Deish, said that nowadays, where he thinks that in certain communities it's really going, if it's done properly, he says you shouldn't have it in a Beit Knesset, you can have it in the hall next to the Beit Knesset, but not the Beit Knesset itself. But he said that if you're going to do it in a way in which it's going to really make the woman, to make the young girl feel excited about the fact that she's now Chayevus B'mitzvos, and the fact that she's going to live a life of Torah mitzvos, so she's going to become more committed to it. So then that's something which is certainly appropriate. But again, just as he said it shouldn't be in the Beit Knesset, we see that he established certain parameters. One has to always consult with the Gedolei Ador to understand exactly what the parameters are. It was a very nice essay as well that was written by our own Rabbi Wiener this past year regarding partnership of Minyanim, in which he talked about how this phenomenon as well is one that has to be examined with a sense of sensitivity towards what are can be presumed to be very, very honorable motivations. Rav Moshe wrote tshuva about how a woman can never really be allowed to volunteer any mitzvah unless it's for sincere motivations. But he said, even assuming sincere motivations, we have to understand that there are halakhic limitations. So halakhic limitations that the Shulchan Aruch paskins very, very clearly, isha lo tikra b'tzibor b'pnei kavod tzibor, lo tikra b'torah b'pnei kavod tzibor, that a woman is simply not allowed to receive an aliyah. And this was never phrased and never expressed as a qualified halacha. In fact, Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg points out that the way in which this halacha is expressed in by the Rambam, it doesn't even start off like the Gemara Megillah says, that Mi'ikar HaDin HaKol Olam Minyan Shiva, that everybody really could be called for an aliyah, including women, but Isha Aval Isha Lo Tikra Aval Amu Chachamim, Isha Lo Tikra B'Torah B'Mei Kavod HaTzibor, but the Chachamim said that a woman shouldn't do it because of Kavod HaTzibor, so the Rambam just starts off with the negative. The Rambam just starts off with the second half of the statement, which is Isha Lo Tikra B'Tzibor B'Mei Kavod HaTzibor, that a woman should not read in the the Torah B'tzibor, B'nei Kavod HaTzibor, so that in order to make it clear that this is an absolute thing, it's not something which is qualified, it's not something which is fungible. You have to know when something is fungible and when something is not fungible. The truth of the matter is that the Bach, in Orach Chaim Siman Nun Gimel, also said there's no mechila on Kavod HaTzibor. When the Gemara says Kavod HaTzibor, it means this is an absolute objective notion of Kavod HaTzibor. You can't have a Tzibor come along and saying, we don't care about our Kavod, we define our Kavod differently. No, this is how the Gemara defines Kavod HaTzibor. This is a certain notion of Kedushas Beis HaKnesses, a certain separation of the genders. That's a very, very integral part of the way in which we comport and conduct ourselves in our Beis HaKnesses. The last thing I'll end off mentioning is I think somebody once drew a distinction between orthodoxy and orthodontics, that there's part of our tradition is orthodoxy, that we are very, very staunch in terms of maintaining our traditions and our Mesorah, but part of, you know, the way in which that Mesorah is applied and plays out in different situations is sometimes done through orthodontics, that you have to figure out what exactly has to be straightened out and exactly how you're going to address every single challenge that confronts us. The other thing that I would mention is that it's important, we're having this discussion in the context of the YU Semicha program, but of course it's important for women to be part of this discussion as well. The women who really are, like in the days of Mitzrayim, where it was B'skus Nashim Tzikaniyos Shnigalo Avosinim Mitzrayim, it's always in the B'skus of the Nashim Tzikaniyos that we're able to be here and that we're able to build a bridge from generation to generation. The Nashim Tzikaniyos in our generation as well have to be a part of this conversation to help us figure out together, collectively, what is necessary in order to build up their Yirah Shemayim and the Shmiras HaMitzvos for themselves and for their ability to continue to contribute and to contribute to pass the Torah Torah to future generations to come. Okay? Okay.